this panel discussion with activists fighting tar sands by rail in the Pacific Northwest. Again, that's In the Blast Zone, a panel on tar sands by rail on Tuesday, January 21st from 7 to 9 p.m. at Patagonia, 1106 West Burnside in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good afternoon. The time is 1 p.m. and you are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM on the dial. And I'm here as part of the special programming Hindsight 2020 with Althea Billings.
Hello.
Hey, how's it going, Althea?
It's going good.
Althea, would you like to introduce yourself?
I'm the news director here at KBOO. Excited to be talking with our guest today.
Would you like to introduce our guest as well?
This is Marvin Pena. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me. And the second day in a row, so that's pretty cool.
Yes, if it sounds familiar, that is because Marvin was on the programming yesterday for More Talk Radio in the morning, and we're talking about the MLK Center and MLK's legacy as part of our special programming for MLK Day, which was yesterday. So hope everyone enjoyed that programming and the holiday itself. So today we are doing, I guess, the part two with Marvin, where we are going to talk more about the labor aspect and analyze and debrief about the last 3 years and where we are now and how did we get here. So take it away.
Yeah. Well, thank you again for having me. I think it has been a rough path, like the last 3 years in terms of labor, and in our case is intertwined with immigration because both affect one and the other. Mm-hmm. Since 2016, this current administration has been really harsh, and the new policies, travel bans, and you name it, and the population that we serve definitely have been affected in many ways, especially trying to, find economic opportunities. Like the closest have been, they have been closing all over the place because of that fear created for the current administration. So it has been a challenge trying to overcome those and try to advocate with the little capacity that we have. And that's why partnering with other organizations is always useful, because by ourselves it's basically impossible to try to accomplish anything.
Mm-hmm. And we should say that you are the grassroots engagement coordinator with VAWS Workers' Rights Education Project. So could you give us a little brief overview of what you do in your work?
Yes, a lot. you wear many hats in nonprofits, but basically, in my case, I've been out pretty much everywhere, from colleges, speaking in neighborhood associations, at the city council. So many different scenarios, different areas in the community that to help not just raise awareness, but understanding the work we do, because especially, as I mentioned, with this administration trying to create fear in the community. So it's being out there clarifying what we do and the reason we do the work we do and what's behind it, and, creating more inclusive spaces. So that's most of my work is basically being out there campaigning and advocating for the population we serve, but in general, like just diversity and immigration, that's completely intertwined with the labor movement too.
And can you just go into a little bit how the last 3 years with all the, the immigration fiascos, yeah, and the bans and all that, how that intersects with labor in the work that you do?
Right. One of the things that a brief summary of all these 3 years. The first thing is that fear created in the community, like, definitely affected how people see the work we do. And the way that looks like is that people are afraid to even hire a worker because he's an immigrant. So that affects his way of living, because now it's less work even. They already face unstable income and so many other barriers, but that's a main one. and not being hired by the community because of this fear, like, am I going to be in trouble if I hire someone there? So if I hire someone, then do this person pay taxes? I mean, there are so many implications that goes with this fear created by the administration that affected. That's like the first step on that. And going along with that, then you have like wage theft situation, which is a big deal because some people sadly take advantage of the workers because, again, the immigration status, and that's definitely connected both. And then they don't pay them. And so that's something that we are trying to, you know, fight back and try to recover those wages. But the same issue has to do with that immigration fear. And I can tell you for experiences and what I heard from the workers, like, basically some of the people can say, what are you going to do? I mean, mm-hmm. that's the way it is. And where are you going to, you know, complain, or where are you going to try to go and prosecute me? Those kind of things. So, again, that's another way that is reflected, like taking advantage of that immigration status to take advantage of the workers or abuse them, or you name it. So many things related to that, just to mention a few.
And so for those people who are, you know, have the inclination to sort of throw their hands up, what can you do about it? How do you fight back against wage theft for immigrants?
In that case, it's tough because as a nonprofit, we cannot do much. But what we can do is, as a community, and again, and going back to being together and partner with other organizations to be able to fight back and to recover these wages. So what we do is, first of all, having a place that they can go and not just vent, but also like taking a notes about the situation and keeping track and see how bad it is, which is sad. But then also, like, we partnered with the Oregon Law Center, who help in some way to follow up with these cases. And if they cannot support us in any way, they referred us to other organizations that work with these kind of issues. Also, being part of other organizations, we can advocate to a more like policy level kind of thing. So going down to Salem or trying to push for certain laws that can prevent this. And one example of that I remember last year, we went down to Salem with a couple of workers, and we, with other organizations, tried to push for a law that was going to fine employers that wouldn't pay properly, or maybe not even paying at all. And with those fines, the money will go to create more capacity at the Bureau of Labor and Industry to actually enforce this. But also some of the money also was going to the worker or workers to compensate that loss. And it hasn't been approved yet, but still that's part of the movement, is trying to keep moving things to get to that level where we actually can see changes. Because unfortunately, even though there are systems in place, we don't have enough people at these institutions to actually prosecute and follow up with these cases. So even though they know existed, they don't have the capacity.
Yeah, it's hard to enforce it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Just in case you are tuning in, you're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, and we are speaking with Marvin Pinna of the grassroots engagement coordinator for VOS, the Worker Center. And we will be taking your phone calls if you have any questions for Marvin, 503-231-8187. Now, looking back in hindsight, 2016, the center helped with the campaigns, you know, the community engagement, mm-hmm. with making the city of Portland and Multnomah County a sanctuary status city. Yeah. How has that helped the center? How has that helped the mission?
Yeah, actually, and we support in those efforts as a ally of the other mm-hmm. organizations, the larger organizations. And I guess the way it helps, even though there's still things going on, and I'm going to talk a little bit about it afterwards, but it helps to prevent more raids or harassment And at least having support to that level, government level, city and county, at least in the paper, try to guarantee some kind of security to the workers and people who seek work, not just at the worker center, but even the corners around. So I guess it's reflecting in a way that you feel some kind of support, that they have your back, even though, you know, that at the federal level is a different issue. But it's important that was said and done, because it shows that there is a widespread support from the community and the city.
Mm-hmm. Could you speak to a little bit the limitations of that sanctuary status? What does it not do, I guess?
I guess in my understanding is, like, because the federal government is a different, you know, agency, a whole issue, and we all saw the news at the ICE detention center and all these kind of things, that we cannot, like, argue or protect our workers from that kind of prosecution or harassment in this case, because that has nothing to do with city and county level. So, and you can see that to the point that we, last year actually, we started to create new drills on what if ICE show up here. Mm-hmm. So you need to rethink the whole thing, because you cannot protect yourself from that, because that's another entity from the government that has nothing to do with the city. So I guess that's something that we cannot do much about. But what we can do is at least try to protect ourselves and the workers from these issues.
And when you saw personally, and then when the community saw all the stuff that is happening on the border and the way that people are being brutalized, what was the response? Did that make the center want to do more in the far as like campaigns about knowing your rights and stuff like that? Or did you really feel, was there a sense of dread?
Yeah, I guess a little bit of both. We definitely emphasized the work about around know your rights and what to do in case of. Mm-hmm. Definitely having the worker center, and we emphasize that with the workers that you have a place, safe place to come, at least as safer as we can make it. Mm-hmm. So, and at the same time, when we have this bad news coming from the border, many of them, so we kind of support in some way, either doing some activities and kind of, yeah, supporting these efforts from other people, because we cannot be there, but we understand the reasons behind it. So, and also it's fearful for most of the workers, because of knowing that that's still going and it's not stopping at anytime soon. So it's hard. So it's a combination of, you know, yeah, hope, but also we need to be careful and what we can do to protect the workers.
In which industries have been affected the most because of just all of this, the presidency and just the climate that we're in?
I guess because in our case, people who support the work we do mostly come from the community, so mm-hmm. homeowners, people from the neighborhood. So I think the way that I saw more like an effect in the worker center especially, it was like less people hiring. So last summer, where supposedly it's one of the highest season, was kind of slow. Mm-hmm. So, and at that time it was again all these raids in other states, so that fear was lingering there, and I think that affected in some way how the community perceived the worker center. And we always try to, you know, the best to our abilities to raise awareness about, you know, these are, as I mentioned yesterday, these are just human beings like you and me with hopes and dreams, and they just need an opportunity to work and learn new stuff and get tools to, you know, empower them to do whatever they feel they need.
Have you found that you've had to confront different misunderstandings about the worker center or the work that you do?
I guess to me, the one of the issues in is to create that connection between the human element and the community understanding that, because yeah, it could be seen like a place to hire someone and then that's it, but it's just emphasizing the work behind it. It's like creating trainings and trying to improve their capacity, their skills, and how to work safely, how to know that they being aware of when someone is taking advantage of them. So there is a lot more than just hiring people. So trying to make that connection with the community sometimes is hard to explain that briefly. And the best way that we can do is when, for example, we organize events, so bringing people to the worker center and seeing the reality there, that's a good way to raise that awareness. And also, it's hard to also showcase that through either social media or newsletters because not many people want to show their mm-hmm. faces. So it's really hard to, and it's completely understandable. So mm-hmm. how you create that element, human element connection, if you cannot even show people's faces. So it's a challenge. It's definitely a challenge.
You know, I'm wondering, because of that situation specifically, you know, I'm just wondering, do you rely a lot on allyship from, you know, white people mostly, like to, you know, because they can show their face, they don't feel that fear. Is there like a big element of relying or, you know, just allyship?
Right. Yes, and but it's an education process as well, because as we know, well, Portland is mostly white people, over 80%, I'm sure. And one of the things, and I mentioned that yesterday, we're trying to eradicate that savior complex of, mm-hmm. you know, saving you, poor you, that kind of thing. And more like, you know, you're creating more spaces for more people, making the city more diverse. And that's a human right and duty as a human being to just create spaces for everyone. And so that's an education part of it. And I'm sure a lot of the people that support us knows that, but still it's good to emphasize it as much as possible. So yes, having allies within the community, regardless of their color or their position, is always good, because then they can spread the word among their people and friends and neighbors mm-hmm. and all that.
So I'm curious about the, I guess, when does that savior complex come up? Does that play into sort of people misunderstanding your work, or?
I guess, well, that's a debate that I have with colleagues and other mm-hmm. colleagues from other organizations. It has to do probably a lot of the help that people provide, which is, I mean, we all are thankful for it, but it sometimes come from like a place of guilt and or trying to, you know, I have the power to do this, therefore then you should do this kind of thing, mm-hmm. or funders. I mean, you can find it at all levels. So I guess, and I was saying that yesterday, I experienced the same as an immigrant. Like, I don't need like charity. It's more like I need just opportunities. Like mm-hmm. you and everyone else has it. I just need the same opportunity that everyone has. That's it. And most of the workers, I will say 100% of them, that's what they need, the same chance that everyone has to thrive, because they have the skills, they have different abilities that they can use to thrive by the way they wanted to. So that's where I see that the most, and hopefully over time people can see, I mean, it's a human right that everyone have the same chances in life, in my opinion, at least, yeah.
Can you just tell a little bit about your background in grassroots organizing, and you're also a journalist, so yeah. Just a little bit about that.
I guess what gives me some kind of authority is that I lived through the same experience for probably 4 to 5 years of the same, well, similar experience than the workers. Every experience is unique, but I lived through it and I saw how, you know, frustrating it is not having the power to decide on your own life, because you have the need to, you know, eat, mm-hmm. for example, paying rent. So you need to swallow so many things and tolerate so many things that you're aware that it's not fair, and you know that, but what can you do? And it's because of the same, you don't have any other chances. So living through that, I figure, like, and using my skills, okay, if there is anything that I can do for this community that at some point in my life I lived through the same, I'll do that. So, and I use my journalism experience, and I also went to school here, so kind of use all the tools. And fortunately, I have the opportunity to know better the system and how to navigate through it. So just knowing that and pass that down to either workers or other people, immigrants that I know, that's giving them tools for them to, you know, move forward in their life. Because I live in myself, like, if you don't have those tools, it's going to be really difficult to move forward.
Yeah, if you don't know the rules to the game, you can't, you know, you're just going to...
You can play.
Yeah, you can't play.
Yeah.
And so with your experience and what you do now and your background, and then, you know, being in Portland and looking back the last few years, can't mention labor and all that without the unionizing and Burgerville and the workers and all that. What was your perception about it?
I think the last, especially the last couple of years, that I have seen more and more movements towards like the unionizing and getting together. Well, we have the Fred Meyer example as well. And so that's something that give me hope as a, well, not just grassroots organizer, but as a worker.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea of that is basically fight for your rights as a community. And unionizing is basically what I mentioned at the beginning. It's just allying, getting allies everywhere to achieve these calls for a livable wage, for, you know, benefit, decent benefits for a worker. So I think the last 2 years has been key, and I think that's not stopping. I've seen that more and more the movement is growing, and I believe it's something that needs to, we can support as much as we can as VOS, as an organization, and but also within our own organization. So just like have leadership that reflects your community. So there are so many layers to that, but I think the union movement is something that came back to stay and keep growing, hopefully.
Do you think that the perception of labor organizing as a practice has changed in the past 3 years?
I think it changed, especially within the immigrant community, because at least in my perception, I'm not an expert, but for what I have seen, especially in the construction industry, like, well, I work in construction for a while, so I see how many, you know, companies have been unionized or unions of carpenters, for example. So, and this is something that the unions support VOS causes to, so I can see how that has been growing also. But then on the other side, because I work in construction, I saw so other many people, undocumented folks, that they could not participate in unions. So again, we're going back to the same issue, not being able to do that, then you are a victim of exploitation and all these kind of issues. So sadly, but that's what it is, and hopefully we can change that and find ways to include these people in the system. That way they have the right to unionize, for example, and then be protected against, you know, abuse and so many other things.
Yeah, that's huge. You know, just because a person is undocumented or however you want to phrase it, doesn't mean that they don't have rights as a worker. And usually people who are put in those positions have to work so incredibly hard in situations that are so grueling, especially in Oregon, when it is, we do have like a lot of farmland and stuff like that. So it's the type of work that, not being protected, you are going to get just brutalized. And so that's, I guess, where the organization comes in, in that intersection and like between, you know, the legalities, unionizing, labor rights, and recognizing that there is a huge disparity between labor unionizing and people and the laborers, basically. And so it's not encompassing, and that's where VOS comes in, and that's amazing. And so you did mention that you've noticed a growth in unionizing. Do you have any opinions as to what sparked this growth?
You know, I guess people just got tired of seeing the same things and the abuse and the, I mean, the livable wages, that's a minimum. And And not many places have that, especially living in Portland. I guess everyone knows that how expensive it could be. And even working a 40 hours a week job, you cannot make it. And even if you're like a single person, I cannot imagine a family of four or five, and they need to pay all this stuff with this kind of wages. So, and you hear this argument that, well, if we raise the wages, then we have more expenses, but then that falls short. Like, you know, if people have more money, they can spend more money in other places. So it's like a full circle effect, in my opinion. I'm not an economist, but just basic reasoning. So I think people just got tired. Like, you know, we need to do something. Otherwise, we won't be able to live even here. Mm-hmm. And you can see how gentrification is pushing people away more and more, and less people of colors live in Portland. And now they are, you know, either Hillsborough, Gresham, mm-hmm. you name it. So it's just enough. Like, people wants to stay where they are. This is their city as well, and they are realizing that, and that's what sparked all this.
Yeah, Joanne Hardesty said that the affordable housing, in order to live somewhere that's affordable housing, you have to make $24 an hour.
Yeah, exactly.
That's not anywhere. It's just ridiculous.
Yeah, it's not even close.
Yeah, and you're making a lot of good points, because it all, you know, it relates to the housing, to the labor, to the legalities, and just to industries as a whole. So if you treat the workers better, you know, industry won't suffer because of that.
In my mind, that's the case. And in both cases, it's even harder, because we're dealing with a particular niche. And actually, mm-hmm. we are the only organization in Oregon that works with day laborers. And so it's even harder to navigate those things for, again, immigration status, then insurance-wise, or, you know, all these different things, certificates. So we're trying to do, one of the things we're trying to do to reduce the gaps and barriers is having, like, safety training, like particular trainings like carpentry or gardening. Also, hopefully soon this year, try to certify a few of the workers in OSHA trainings.
Oh, great.
Because the idea is to give them the tools and resources for them to know how to work safely, not risk their own, you know, body doing the work. So there are a few other things that we're doing with the little capacity we have, but trying to improve their working life in this case. That's the kind of things that we can do. And whatever we cannot do, then we refer them to other organizations, because we have things like homelessness. We have mm-hmm. things like mental health issues. So there are so many variables that play into the work we do. And at least we try to focus on that work aspect of their life. Yeah.
Yeah. Just in case you are just tuning in, we are speaking with Marvin Pina, who is the grassroots engagement coordinator for Voss Workers Center, and we are talking about the last 3 years, workers' rights, and the intersection between immigration and day laborers. If you want to join the conversation, you can feel free to do so. Call us, 503-231-8187. Althea, take it away.
Yeah, sure. Well, I think it's very important, as you've noted, that the value of day laboring, labor in general, is so entwined with, you know, what that wage is going to be. And then the wage informs housing affordability and all of these different things about where people find themselves in the city. So yeah. I'm curious, how does public opinion play into the success of a unionization effort?
Like, can you repeat the question?
Yeah. I'm thinking about, like, public perception mm-hmm. of labor organizing in general.
Mm-kay.
How does that, you know, help or hurt a unionization effort?
I guess, well, for what I have seen in either news and I think it's like 50-50. I feel like some people believe that unionizing will, you know, affect companies or, you know, destroy. Some people might get fired because of now paying higher wages than the companies they don't have enough money for it. So that's one side of it. And the public opinion that I have seen and I hear from from, you know, news to what you read on either social media or news outlets. But on the other hand, as we were talking about, like, the wages have been like a big issue the last, well, many years, mm-hmm. but especially the last 4-5 years, where when Portland has been increasing rent and every cost of living. And yeah, like that public opinion. And then we have Burger Bill, then we have Fred Meyer, we have even Amazon trying to do some unionizing too. So definitely public opinion plays a role in unionizing. And I think in my mind is playing now more and more towards like favoring unionizing, not so much about against it. So yeah, it's definitely a factor for sure.
Right. Yeah. Especially because, I mean, the U.S. generally doesn't really have a strong culture around unionizing when you compare it to the rest of the world.
Yeah.
Got too scared by communism in the 1950s to really let that have any power.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I'm wondering, going back to, or I guess looking forward in the future, the 2020 census, if someone is undocumented, or is that the proper phrase, or is that
undocumented will be the most decent one?
Unfortunately.
Yeah.
An undocumented laborer, how can they fit into the census? Do they even have an option of fitting into the census without any kind of legal repercussion? I know that earlier in the year, in 2019, they were mentioning the part about are you an immigrant, which I cannot imagine why anyone who's an immigrant would ever want to answer that question.
Right.
So how can someone, you know, in that situation, how can they, where do they fit in the census?
No, there are ways, fortunately, and I'm part of a larger organization or efforts. Well, there are many.